This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Toda rabba. I think I should start with thanks before I forget at the end, both to the Pritler family, Dina and Mark, wherever he is, and to Rabbi Alex Israel, who's not present today, but he was responsible for all the organizational issues, including preparing the handouts, which I found the best handouts I ever had, out of my own, of course. After discussing in three meetings different stories of the rabbis about the biography, especially pre-birth stories, and then about family affairs and public affairs, it's time now to speak about folk tales or folk stories, but let me explain what the problem is and I'd like to solve it. The stories which we read so far were created by the rabbis, most probably within the walls of the Beit Midrash, for different reasons, but there are stories that were composed by the rabbis themselves and maybe taught to the public, to the masses, but basically they are made in the Beit Midrash. But there must be some stories that were told out of the walls of the Beit Midrash, stories that mothers or parents told their children and the older people of the society told the younger, so whatever. I mean, where are those stories? You cannot assume that the Jewish people, of all peoples around the world, did not have their own folk stories. Since the great project of the Grimm brothers, you know, the Grimm brothers, who collected European stories, German and French stories, the whole idea of learning, teaching, collecting, analyzing folk tales is widespread all over, especially in the Baltic countries, but not only. And we are not very different from them all. And today you may know there are still folk tales which are told in many communities in Israel today. In Haifa, in University of Haifa, there is what we call the Archeon LaSipur HaMami BeYisrael, the archives of the folk story in Israel. They've collected in the last 50 years about 24,000 stories that were told in different moshavim, different societies, Haredim and Olim from other places. And the stories are there, analyzed, and you can learn a lot about the people of Israel by reading the stories, because Am Israel is not Agnon, and Am Israel is not Bialik, and Am Israel is not whatever. The stories which are told again and again, father to children, or parents to children, and for generation, they may reflect the real nature of these people, of any people, than the texts that were created by great poets or writers. I think one of the most important part of this history of the folk tales is a letter that was, printed in some American journal during the Second World War, or maybe just after the Second World War, when people were astonished. How can the German, a nation which brought together Beethoven and Goethe and whatever, it's impossible that these people could behave in such a cruel way. And then they said, look at the folk stories. See about, in Hebrew it's Ami and Tami, maybe Hansel and Gretel, about parents, a mother who sent, Shilgia?
Snow White,
Kippa Aduma, Riding Red Hood. These are cruel stories. It's cruel stories about neglecting children, about wolf swallowing. But that's the real nature of mid-European society, say this guy. If you want to understand the German culture as a whole, do not look at Goethe and Beethoven, but see the whole picture, and part of it is folk stories. And I think it's important for us to understand that by analyzing, or by realizing, or by deciding which stories in rabbinic literature originated outside of the walls of the Beit Midrash and were imported into the Beit Midrash, may teach us something about the nature of the people who surrounded the world of the rabbis, because all we know about the rabbis is by the text of the rabbis. Archaeology helps us very little. Basically, we know nothing about the common people at that time. what was the status of mitzvot which they kept? I mean, we know nothing about the general public. We know about the rabbis, but the rabbis is a small group. We know about 2,400 names of rabbis. I mentioned it, I think, in the first meeting. It's nothing, 2,400 people in 600 years. What about the masses? Demographers tell us that people of Israel were about 2 to 3 million people at that time, each generation. So 600 years, it's about 20 generations, times 20 million, so 40 million people. What about their culture? And for that, in the last 50 years, Hebrew University in Jerusalem were the pilot, the first one, Professor Dov Noy, of blessed memory, who decided that we have to try and find within the 1,000 or so stories incorporated in the Talmud and Midrashim, those which we can somehow identify as a folk story, which means it was told also, or basically, outside of the synagogue or the Beit Midrash, and later on it was imported for some reason into this sacred text. So we assume that there must be, there were folk stories. We assume that some of them are found in our sources. What's the problem? How can you prove that? No story in rabbinic literature begins with, hey, hey, I'm a folk story, please read me. No. But based on the vast scholarship and research of folk stories all around the globe, it can be Norway and Australia and Africa and you name it where, scholarship or scholars of folk stories have managed to get to some rules of the folk story which are true to all folk stories wherever you go and hear them. Because basically, human beings are human beings. And the same stories can be found both in Africa and Australia and in the far north and whatever. If you understand what are the rules of this, the folk stories, and I'm going to use the rules of folk stories as formulated by a scholar called Axel Olrik, O-L-R-I-K. He was Norwegian, Olrik, already in 1908. In 1908, after collecting many stories from different societies, he realized that basically all the stories that are told from generation to generation by the whole society, that is the definition of folk story. Folk story is a story that is told orally from generation to generation by the whole society. By saying society, I do not mean all the people of Israel. Society can mean women of Mea Shearim. That's a society. Society can mean Olim from Ethiopia, whatever. But when the whole society is taking part in transferring the stories from generation to generation, so you have to prove that the story was told by my grandmother, my mother, and I'm telling the story to my kids, that makes the story as a story that was transformed or transmitted one generation. And if the same story is told by me and by other people who belong to my society, and it's told orally, that's something which is going to be gone away in few generations, because now we are reading Kippah Adama, we are reading Kippah Adama, we are reading Peter, whatever, from books. But I think that when I was a child, my parents did not read me a book. They just told me a story. So remember my father, let me, if you like, my father. The story about Kippah Aduma, what's again in English, Kippah Aduma, red? I still remember. It was in the 50s, I was a young child. It was in Israel, the Tzena. You remember the time of the Tzena? People, we waited months and months for the care packages to come from America to have a little chocolate and who knows what. It was great to get the and condensed sweet milk. And you used to tell me that Kippah Aduma, I'll use the name Kippah Aduma, took a basket, put inside, and I insisted, condensed milk, and went. On the way, she made the big woof. What do you have in your basket? And she told me, I have a condensed milk. We have to repeat the whole story. And then she gave it to Sapta. I mean, that's one of the rule of the folk story, by the way, the repetition. So anyhow, but I was told, never read the story to me. If I do, I read it from some books to my grandchildren. Anyhow, Olrik formalized the rules of the folk story. 1908 still are being used as the best tool to identify a story when you cannot prove that this is a folk story just but by reading it. What are the rules of the folk story? There are many, about 20 rules of form. For example, repetitions. You may remember the story about the sick mother, and the doctors told her that only a flower which can be found beyond seven seas and seven mountains can heal her. And you may remember that the oldest son woke up in the morning, took a basket, put inside condensed milk, cheese, and went. And after 3 days, he met a little sheep, right? And she asked him to share with it the cheese, and he refused. And of course, he didn't find the flour. So the next day, the second son got up, and again he took a basket. 3 days, he met the sheep. The things happened. And the third day, what happens? The youngest, what happened there? He gets up in the morning, take the cheese, whatever. And he meets the sheep, and in this case, he gives the sheep something to taste, and suddenly the sheep becomes a beautiful bird, and bird takes him on her wings to beyond the seven seas and whatever, and then he takes the flower and gets home, but alas, the mother died just before he got home. Right? No. Why no? Because in the folk story, the first rule is that the end is known from the very beginning. Kippa Aduma, whatever her name is, she will not be swallowed by the bed wolf. And Ami Vitami, Hansel Gretel, will return home in time, and the witch will be burned. We know that from the very beginning. When you folk story never ends as in a negative way, in a disappointing way. It always fits your inner hopes, because at least in folk stories everything goes as it should go. Maybe in other stories tragedies happened, not in a folk story. That's one of the rules of Ulrik. And a second rule of Ulrik is that always something supernatural, something which you cannot find on a daily basis. It can be a witch, it can be what's Freya? Fairy. Yeah, you know what I mean? That changes a mouse into a carriage rider. Whatever. I mean, something supernatural. Yeah, something which is not on the ordinary daily. Sometimes it's something but just a lucky meeting. The moment you wanted to see someone, you see him, that's already can be considered as a supernatural. And all folk stories, wherever you look, Argentina and Norway, Oceania and China, are obeying, are going according to these two rules. Otherwise, people will not tell them again and again, because somehow it gives some satisfaction to your hope, to your belief. At least in the stories, the world is behaving the right way. On the other hand, there's forms, not only content, form. Repetitions. I give an example, repetitions. Dialogues. You never said that when the wolf asked the Kippa Aduma, what is she carrying in her basket? She answered him by telling, no. The wolf, what are you having there? Kippa Aduma, you know the dialogue. You play it. Even when people read it today, they can play it. Dialogues. Dialogues allow you to change your voice, the tone, and whatever. And repetitions, and very important, rhetorical questions. What is a rhetorical question? This was one. What is a rhetorical question? A rhetorical question is a question which the narrator is going to tell you in a moment the answer. So ask the question. Okay, why ask the question if you're going to tell me? Because it was proven that by asking a question which in a second will be answered, you make the people who listen to participate in you in thinking. What are the possibilities? On the other hand, it helps me, the one who narrates the story, to decide what to do next. Because when I compose a story to my grandchildren, and then the door opened, and what did we see in the door? Till I ask the question, I've decided what was in the door, right? I mean, it helps you to tell the story correctly. So we have rhetorical questions, repetitions, we have alliterations which play to the ear but not to the eye. And always on the stage, two figures. We cannot have at the same time three figures on the stage. So if there are Kippa Aduma and her mother, then the mother goes on, and Kippa Aduma and the wolf. Then the wolf and the Sapta Kippa Aduma, because you cannot tell at the same time about three figures which are participating in the story. And many more other rules which I'm going to show you in the stories that we are going to read, which according to Ulrik and Dov Noy of blessed memory, who mentioned already, Steve, try to see as a way to identify those stories in rabbinic literature which most probably, we cannot be sure more than that most probably came out from outside of the walls of the synagogue or the Beit Midrash, inside for many, for reasons, variegated reasons. All of them are anonymous. I mean, the hero of the story is once a man, a king, a child, never a somebody you can a sage or something like that. And many of the stories are in Aramaic, which also proves to their original form in the public who spoke Aramaic. So if you take a story in Biblical literature with Aramaic and is anonymous and has expect the end is expected from the very beginning, and you have many, many rhetorical devices, although it's already written down. When people wrote down, they still were motivated by the way they were telling the story. So when they wrote the story down, they still wrote it down the way they used to tell it. It's very interesting. So rhetorical questions were maintained and repetitions were maintained. Repetitions is very ugly in a written text. The next morning, the second psalm went and failed. No, the next morning, the same words. He woke up, he took a basket and condensed milk and whatever. You won't understand the condensed milk. You were not here. And the repetition, but still is kept in the writing. My late professor, Ezra Fleischer, once found a manuscript of a poem, or maybe a song, it's a little distinction, in which the writer wrote la 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 la. He wrote the whole la 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 in the text, because that's the way he used to sing the song, la 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 la. So now we are going to read some stories which obey to some extent to the rules, on which there is a general agreement within scholarship that they exhibit or reflect the common people, the folk, more than the rabbis. But the rabbis decided to bring them into their sources for many reasons, which we may discuss or not, depends on the time that we have. So I think that we start by a story that you don't have. I'll tell you a story, okay? You don't have to listen to me. I try to do it as original as it was. It's a famous story, but it is built by three phases. The first one is today told to children in the elementary school till the age of Kita Vav. The second phase is told when they get to Kita Yud. I'm serious. And the third phase only when they are maturing and ready for life in the 12th grade. And when I tell you the story, I'll tell you what is told where in what, of course, in Aramaic. Hadrian, the Caesar, Hadrian the Caesar, of course, immediately may his bones be ground up, because Yishar Koach tamid notim l'adam kaze, was walking through the path of Tiberias. He saw an old man standing and digging holes to plant trees. He said to him, old man, if you got up early to do the work when you were young, you would not have stayed long to plant it in your old age. I got up early and worked in my youth, and I stayed late working in my old age. And whatever pleases the Master of Heaven, let him do. By your life, old man, how old are you today? I'm 100 years old. Now you are 100 years old and you are standing and digging holes to plant trees. Do you honestly think that you are going to eat the fruit of those trees? It's still Kita Gimel, yes, Tu Bishvat story. If I have the merit, I shall eat it. But if not, well, just as my forefathers labored for me, so I labor for my children. By your life, if you have the merit of eating of the fruit of the trees, be sure to let me know about it. After some time, the trees produced figs. The man said, well, that's the time come to tell the king. What did he do? Rhetorical question. What did he do? He filled a basket with figs and went up and stood at the gate of the palace. The guards say to him, what is your business here? I came to see the king. When he had got in, he said to him, "What, the king, what are you doing here?" He said to him, I am the old man that you met. I was the one who was digging holes to plant trees, and you say to me, if you have the merits of eating the fruits of those trees, be sure to let me know. Now, I in fact did have the merit, and I ate of this fruit, and these figs here are the fruit of those trees. The king said, I order you to bring a chair of gold for him to sit. I order you to empty his basket and fill it with golden dinars. His servants say to him, Are you going to pay so much respect to the old Jew? He said to them, His creator honored him. And should I not honor him? That's the end of the story taught to children in the third, fourth, sixth grade. Of course, you may understand that the addition, Hadrian, Yimach Shmo, is an automatic way that some writer added the Mishnah Berach without really understanding that this story, Hadrian is portrayed as a positive, as enlightened Caesar, which he really was, who honored an old Jew just because he appreciated the way in life. And of course, the idea is what parents do with us, we do for our children, to Bishvat story, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, Kita Gimel. You get to high school, Kita Tet, the 9th, 10th grade, the story goes on. The wife of this man was a wicked person. She said to her husband, Son of darkness, see how the king loves figs and trade them for golden dinars. What did the man do? He filled a sack with figs and went and stood before the palace. What's your business here? I heard that the king loves figs and trade them with golden dinars. They went and told the king, There is an old man standing at the gate of the palace carrying a sack full of figs. When we asked him, What are you doing here? He told us, I heard that the king loves figs and trade them for golden dinars. See the repetition. The king said, I order you to set him up before the gate of the palace, and whoever goes in and out, throw the figs at his face. That's the second phase. What's the idea? No free lunch, of course. You cannot make easy buck if you don't work for it. Kita Yudit's okay. But when you're ready for the real life, they are taught the story as it really ends. Toward evening, they freed him, and he went home, swallowed of the figs. He said to his wife, For all the honor that I got, I owe you. She said, Go and boast to your mother that they were figs and not etrogim, that they were soft and not hard. And of course, you have to blame the woman always. And in the Aramaic is more coarse than go and boast to your mother. She's really cursing him by mentioning his mother. But this is a folk story. You can hear that it's very simple. It's not very deep. There are a lot of repetitions, rhetorical questions, dialogues. If I were an actor, I could play. The king would speak in one accent, like Hungarian, and he would speak in another, American, or whatever. I mean, you can do it a whole show by telling this story. It's found in Vayikra Rabbah, my most beloved Midrash, of course. This is a great folk story, by the way, which is told in other societies than ours, because it's not a story that should be limited to the Jewish people only. Another example, and then we make it more complicated, will be text number 4. Text number 4. You won't be surprised to see it's Vayikra Rabbah, right? I said more than once. It's a great Midrash. Leviticus Rabbah. Text number 4. We'll do it in English, okay? Yeah. It discusses the sacrifice of a bird. And he shall rent it by the wings thereof, but shall not divide it asunder. Which means when the dove is being the korban as a sacrifice, the Kohen takes it by two wings and tear it into two after taking his head off and tearing into two and throwing it to the on the altar without taking out not the wings and not the legs and not whatever. The whole dove is being sacrificed. Rabbi Yochanan said, An ordinary being should smell the odor of burning wings is nauseated, that's a word, nauseated, thereby. And you say, And the priest shall make it smoke up on the altar. Are we going to sacrifice to God something which stinks? Like, because you know that burning wings are really smelly. But we are sacrificing them. Why then all this? Just in order that the altar may be enhanced by the sacrifice of a poor person. That was what poor people could bring. Not a huge animal, but at least little dove. Now, if you take the dove and you leave only, you take out the wings, you take the head, and you take off the legs, what is left? Nothing, you know. So, in order not to humiliate the poor people, God is ready that on his altar there will be stinking birds. That's the Midrash. And now the story. King Agrippa. King Agrippa, we don't know exactly who he was because there were two kings Agrippa. Not everybody remembers. Two kings, father and son. The last kings of the Hasmonean dynasty, Agrippa. In Jerusalem is the Rehov Agrippas. You may remember, but lately, after Agrippa Street was taken to some local rabbi, so from Agrippa's, only Agrippa was now Agrippa we have from that, but anyhow, Agrippa was one of the kings at the beginning of the common area, and King Agrippa wished to offer up 1,000 bird offerings in one day. Exaggeration. That's another thing the folk stories. 1,000. You cannot sacrifice 1,000 cows on the altar in the Bet Mikdash. Nothing you can do about it. It's 300,000 kilos of meat. But he wanted to sacrifice 1,000 sacrifices in one day. He sent to tell the high priest, "Let no man other than myself offer sacrifices today." Okay? That may be some historical notion that the kings had really some influence on the Beit Mikdash at that time, and they could give instruction to the high priests, who were nominated twice a year by the king, usually after paying for the honor to be high priest. Anyhow, so he tells the high priest, "Nobody but me, only me today." There came a poor man with two turtle doves in his hand. And he said to the high priest, "Sacrifice this." I'm an old man. Said he, the king commanded me, saying, "Let no man other than myself offer sacrifice this day." Repetition. Said he, "My lord the high priest, I catch 4 every day. 2 I offer up, and with the other 2 I sustain myself. If you do not offer them up, you cut off my means of sustenance." This poor guy, every day, manages to find to catch 4 doves, and every day, by going home with his daily catch, whatever, he sacrifices 2. And he believes, a very popular, naive belief, that he and God are partners in the business, and God demands his 50%. If I won't give him today the 50%, I won't be able to catch something tomorrow, please sacrifice them. I'm not sure that the rabbis would love such a way of looking at God. As somebody you make cheshbonot with him and exactly how much I give him, how much you give me. What happens if you give him 3 out of 4 or give him nothing? No, that's the way the common people, this man sees that. And you see the distinction or the contradiction between the king with a name to some poor man. 1,000 into 2, which is the minimal amount of animals that can be sacrificed, with olot, which is cows, and dardel doves. But the king wanted to do it one day, and this guy does it every day, and the priest was in a conflict. What did he do? The priest took them and offered them up. He probably assumed that no one realized the 2 dardel doves are among 300,000 kilos of burning meat. Yes, nobody realized, but in heaven they realized. And that's the supernatural element. In a dream, it was revealed to Agrippa, the sacrifice of the poor man preceded you, which means it was accepted in heaven more favorably than your 1,000 show of sacrifices. Then the king sent to the high priest saying, "Did I not command you thus? Let no one but me offer sacrifices this day?" Said he to him, "Your majesty," now the repetition, "a poor man came with 2 turtle doves in his hand and said to me, 'I catch 4 birds every day. I sacrifice 2, and from the other 2 I support myself. If you will not offer them up, you will cut off my means of sustenance. Should I not have offered them up?'" Wow. Said the king, No, and killed him on the spot. That's how I would end the story. Because he did not obey the king. No, say the king, you were right in doing as you did. The beggar and the rich person, of course, we are the beggars. We want the old man or the poor man to win over the great king. And of course, the story did it this way. We are relieved now. Fine. Do not be in despair. There is justice somewhere. And even to doubt the love can be more important than the whole 1,000 sacrifices of a king. It's a folk story. What is it doing in the Midrash? I don't have the time to talk about it, but you see, when we read it about the repetitions, about the dialogues, about the contradiction, 1,002, king and a poor man, and the idea of the story is, as I said before, we wanted the man from the very beginning. I do it a lot. Many times I teach a story to my students, but I don't give them the end. And they know exactly how the end will be. The prince on the white horse will come on time, don't worry. And the poison apple did not kill, but she'll wake up. And whatever you know, what you know from the very beginning, and the condensed milk will get on time, that's assure us the way we want the story to be told. And this is two examples of some of the 12 or 15 stories which Dovnoy and his students believe to be a folk story, although the proof is, you know, in a circular way. It obeys the rules of Orlik. It's Orlik. It's an Aramaic. It doesn't mention specific names of rabbis. So it may be a story that was told also outside of the synagogue or the Beit Midrash. But I like to make it more complicated, because that was very simple, by reading a story, not an easy one, and usually I work very hard to convince people in the way I read it. Text number two. I'll mention for the last time that it's taken from Leviticus Rabbah. That's it. That's Leviticus Rabbah. Midrash on Vayikra with most beautiful stories. But it happens. It begins with a verse from the book of Job. In Hebrew, Ki poal adam yeshalem lo ukeorach ish yamtzienu. Or English, for the work of a man will he pay him and cause every man to find himself according to his ways. One of the friends of Job trying to convince him that if he was punished correctly, because God gives everyone a reward or punishment according to his deeds. For the work of man he pays him, and everyone finds himself, with the help of God, walking in the way in which he wanted to walk. That's the idea of the verse for the book of Job, and that's the beginning of our story about a story is told. I mean, the English. A story is told that a certain man had two sons, one of whom practiced charity, while the other did no charitable deed at all. If you look in the Aramaic second line, you can see that charity is called mitzvah. And in rabbinic literature, stam mitzvah is tzedakah. It's very nice. Also, you don't say a blessing on that tzedakah. Asher kitchanu v'latet tzedakah. But tzedakah is considered the most important, the only tzedakah, which is the only mitzvah, which is to do a mitzvah, is tzedakah. So one son did many mitzvot, the other one did no mitzvot at all. The one who practiced charity sold his house and all that he had, and spent the proceeds as charity. Now the story begins. Once, on Hoshana Rabbah, and I assume that this audience does not have to know what Hoshana Rabbah is all about, his wife gave him 10 pulsin, a small amount of money, very small amount of money, and say to him, go and buy something for your children in the market. Or in Aramaic, fourth line, puk zbun levanecha klum min ashuk, mishuka. Levanecha, your children. You know how much stress I'm putting on the banecha? She's not saying baneinu, she's saying banecha. I feel some bitterness here. He sold everything they had, the house, the furniture, whatever, for doing tzedakah. And then when the poor woman on eve of Chag, Shmini Atzeret, Shana Rabbah, has some money, she sends him to the shuk to buy something for your kids. You have kids too, take care of them. And he takes the money and goes out to the shuk. But no sooner had he gone out than the charity collectors met him. Every society in rabbinic time, every year, nominated two people to be the charity collectors who would go from door to door and demand people to participate in the great mitzvah of tzedakah. So, Gabbai Tzedakah. They said, here comes the Lord of Charity. Some translate into English, here comes Mr. Charity. He is the one who always give. You know, when you approach him, he'll never say no. He is the Lord of Charity. Give your share, they begged, to this charity, for we are buying a dress for a certain orphan girl. Nice cause for charity. So he took the 10 pulsin and gave them to the men. Now, the original is six lines in the Hebrew. Or at least it's my text. Sorry, I don't have the same text you have. But if you are more or less the middle of the text, Nidbayesh leilech etzel ishto. He was ashamed to return to his wife. The original Aramaic, Me'asa, you see the Me'asa in the Hebrew? The English translator did not do it because he thought it's important. But this is the real rhetorical question. What will happen now? When I teach this story with a computer, each time I bring one sentence, that's the place I stop. What will happen now? Ask the people, what happened now? The little money that his wife gave him to spend for his kids, he gave to some girl. What will be happen now? And I get all kinds of answers. Very interesting. Only religious people say, Alach lebet haKnesset. Synagogue as a haven from the wife, you know. I cannot put the kids to sleep. I have Mariv. I cannot help now. I have Shachris. I mean, that's nice. We all know that synagogue can be a nice haven for men. Anyhow, that happened here. Nidbayesh lalechet etzel ishto me'asa halach lebet haKnesset. Or in the English, being ashamed to go home, he went to the synagogue. Maybe I should use this one as well. Okay. Where are we now, more or less? Synagogue. Then he saw some of the citrons, that's the etrogim, that the children throw about on Hoshana Rabbah. If you do not remember Yush Mishnah, and the Mishnah is telling us that every day in Sukkot they went around the altar and they're doing the Hoshana ceremony, but on Hoshana Rabbah it's done seven times, and after the seventh times, in a second, split of a second, the citrons and the dulav, whatever, loses their gdusha, more or less. More or less, because they finished their function for the hakafot. So this very moment, and the Mishnah tells us, at this very moment, the kids waited for a whole week to take the citron and play with it and play with the lulav and whatever. The kids are jumping on the four arba minim, and that's the moment when he got there. You see now, he went to the synagogue. Then he saw some of the citrons that the children throw about on Hoshana Rabbah. As we have learned elsewhere in the Mishnah, that it is permitted to take away the palm branches from the children. Here I must ask you to look at the original text, because something very interesting happens in here. If you see where the Mishnah is cited, that Ninan Taman, we have learned there, Miyad HaTinokot, Shomtin et lulavehen v'ochlim et rugehen. What is miyad? Usually miyad means immediately. But miyad can be also out of the hand. And probably the Mishnah really meant miyad. Just immediately after the Hoshana, the kids are jumping on the etrogim, on the lulav, and having great time. But our story, and Rashi follows the story, saying miyad, out of the hand of the kids. It's okay, the kids won't mind. It's a celebration, it's a simcha. So you take an etrog, you give a bite to the peitam. A whole week you were won't be careful not to let the etrog fall down. And who knows what happened to you if it falls down. And now you can eat the etrog. By the way, etrog were eaten at that time. Etrogim were eaten at that time. You can play with the lulav and you do whatever you want. A whole hallelujah. So he got to the synagogue at this very moment, and he took from the hand, miyad, תלמיד, מיד הילדים, he took the citrons for them, filled a huge sack with them, and set out on a voyage upon the great sea, till he reached the king's province. When he arrived there, it so happened that the king felt a pain in his bowels, and was told by the physicians, "This is your cure. Eat of those citrons which the Jews use in their prayer on Hoshana Rabbah, and you will be healed." Now, what will happen? What will happen now? Come on. Yeah, and? And the king will be healed. And at the end of the story? Of course, you know, but you want to hear it. That's what happened exactly. But wait, there's some surprise somewhere. So thereupon, they searched all ships in all the province, but could find none. They went and found that man sitting on his sack. "Have you anything with you?" they asked. I asked him, "I'm a poor man," he replied. "I have nothing to sell." They rummaged in his sack and found some of those citrons. "Where are these from?" they inquired. He told them that they were of those which the Jews used in their prayers on Hoshana Rabbah. They lifted the sack and brought it to the king, and it so happened that he ate the citrons and was cured. How did you know that? You never read the story before. He, the king, ordered, "Empty his sack and fill it with denarii." So they did. Then he returned home safely. Fine? Exactly what we wanted. We wanted this man to be rewarded for doing all this mitzvot. And of course, it's a story for Shavuot, Sukkot, by the way. He, of course, God is behind the story. He brought him to the exact place where the king needed an etrog, and they found the etrog, and denari. Very nice. And that's how the story is found in the famous Sefer Agadah, by Bialik and Ravnitsky. That's how the story is told to kids. It's found in many books for children. They speak about tzedakah, and the importance of tzedakah. And some scholars bring the story, the folk story, that says, give and trust God, eventually you will be rewarded. Hallelujah. But, there is a but. In the manuscripts of the Midrash, the manuscript of Leviticus Rabbah, the story does not end here. It continues with text number 3. And that's what makes the whole question more interesting and the whole story more complicated. They did so, gave a denarii, but he did not go home. The king said to him, "Ask any other favor and I grant you it to you." He answered, "I beg that my property be returned to me and that all the people shall come out to meet me." The king suggested one favor, he asked for two. First of all, he wants a welcome, public welcome. He wants the honor, everybody to see. And of course, good neshamot, there are some good neshamot. So yes, of course, you want to see people, to show people how important it is to give tzedakah. So if everybody comes to see him, they understand the importance of tzedakah. Wait, but what's the idea of, "I want my property to be returned to me"? What is my property? The sack with etrogim? What are you going to do now with sack of etrogim months or weeks after Sukkot? I think what he's asking basically, that everything which he sold, the house and the furniture and whatever, he wants the king to give an order, since the king is the king of the whole area, to give an order that people will give him back his property. And here again, commentators differ. Does he want to pay people to get it back? Or does he want to get it back because he has the power, or the king has the power to order you to give him back whatever he sold to you, because I'm the king and I'm ordering so. But anyhow, what he is asking is very strange. He wants back his property and he wants people to meet him. Okay, let's go on. This was done for him. When he arrived at his own province, a herald preceded him and all the people came out to meet him. His brother, we forgot the brother, right? We had the brother at the beginning of the story, which disappeared during the story. Now this brother comes again. His brother and his children, came to meet him as well. And the big question will be in a second, whose children? because the Aramaic or even the Hebrew or in the English can mean his brother and his brother's children, or his brother and his, came to meet him as well. As they were crossing a river, the current of the river caught them and carried them off. They all drowned in the river when they came to meet the father and brother coming back. Thus it turned out that he entered into his house and inherited his own property. That's the only place in rabbinic literature which I found this term of somebody inheriting his own property. I would say this is a euphemism for someone who inherits his kids instead of giving them instead of them being the heir of his own kids. I don't have an understanding for that. He inherited his own property and his brother's property. So he comes home with a sack full of gold and his house is back to him. And this confirms the text, but to prove that God, for the work of a man, will he pay unto him. Everyone is being paid by God in the way he behaved. And now I have a problem in seeing the story in different light. The way we read it in text number 2 and stopped here, it was simple folk story with some problems. At least two problems, I see them. One of all is exaggerating giving tzedakah. You are not supposed to give whatever you have and become poor because doing tzedakah. And then he's running away. It's a shameless behavior. Because what happens if his wife will be aguna? The kids will be, it's irresponsible to run away, but it does that. But when you read the story, text number 2, and stopped at the end, it did not bother us that much. Because we knew that at the end he'll be rewarded, he'll return home with gold and bamba to the kids and new dress to his wife, hallelujah. We expected that. But when you read the original story, including next number 3, we have to rethink about the whole story from the very beginning. That's what I'd like to analyze now. But say my conclusion. The narrator of text number 3 is using a folk story, which is built according to the pattern of folk stories, but at the end he makes such a twist that forces you to go back and read the story anew and understand that it's not as simple as it is, and it's not the way it is now, it's not a folk story. First of all, it was composed by the rabbis, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, and we know at that time, it was already a rule in Usha already, that you cannot give to tzedakah more than 20% of your income and property. Amevazbez, al yevazbez, yoter michomesh, 20%, that's it, twice maaser. Because if you give too much, at the end, you are the needy, right? And we know what are the historical setting for this idea. Christianity. This new to be a religion, it's still part of Judaism, really believed in poverty as a way of life. And giving the money to the community, to the congregation, to the church, so to speak, and go around the world with your dress on you only, and whoever created the day will create your food. And God, that is the New Testament, who gives food to the bird and to the foxes will give you food. Don't worry. You may remember the story, the name of the rose. Have you seen the movie, The Name of the Rose? You remember what was the occasion for which Sean Connery went all the way as a priest to that place in somewhere mid Europe to discuss with the church people from Rome. The whole discussion was whether the coat of Jesus was his own, or maybe even that was borrowed. He had no property at all. That was the big debate between Rome and the Franciscanism or the whatever. Poverty is a way of life, and it was very tempting. I cannot understand. I fully can understand the average farmer in the Galilee in the 3rd century when he has to pay high taxes to the Roman government, high taxes to God, Shemitah, Masrot, don't underestimate it, and high taxes to the patriarch, the patriarchate also demanded, give it something to tzedakah, and now you are free, and you go around the world, you do whatever you want. I understand the temptation on that, And that's why in Usha already, first century, second century, you cannot give to charity more than 20%. But this man gives and gives and gives, and I understand why he's doing it. It's not because of love of people. He need the status of a charity giver. He has holes in the hand, as my mother would have said. He always gives. He cannot say no. And people know that. In even called him behind his back, you know, Mr. Cherry comes, he probably will give us. And he failed because it was wrong to do, because he was ashamed to go back home. He ran away because he cannot face his wife and tell her what he was doing now. If he did it from wholeheartedly as a true way of life, why run away? Why being ashamed? He behaved in the wrong way, and the two brothers behaved in the wrong way. One did not give it all, and the other one gave, and gave, and gave, and gave. And the story is out. Now we are, the one who gave was learned this lesson. He ran away, sacrificed his wife, knows what could happen to her, and he got to this place, and God, and the king, and the healing. That's according to the folk story. And then he got the money, and here he could have gone back home with the gold and say thank you, and continue by helping everybody else. No. The king gave him the chance of his life. Ask whatever you want. And he's asking two things. Honor, he needs honor. He wants everybody to greet him. And he wants his property back. What property? You gave the property for making tzedakah. But now that you already have the honor of being whatever you are, you don't want it, you want it back. You never gave it really from your good heart. And if you look at the story again, everything that he gave was from some other people's property. The money was his wife. The citrons were the kids, the children's. The house which he sold, he got back to him. So the poor people who bought the house for him basically paid for the tzedakah. So he gets home. He want honor, he got honor. He want money, he got money. What did he lose? Lost his family. Because he neglected his family from the very beginning. That's the idea, is that God is giving everybody to find himself in the way that he wants. I would say the story has three points. Honor, money, and family. He neglected the family and wasted the money in order to get honor. When he got honor, he lost family and got as much money as he can. It reminds me of the Greek story about King Midas. Midas, what's his English name? Midas. He wanted gold, right? He loved gold, and the gods gave him the touch of gold. But what's the end? He died of hunger, right? He couldn't eat anything, and his daughter, when he embraced her, she became a statue of gold. This man wanted money, he got money. He wanted honor, got honor. But who pays the price? The family. That's why I believe that at the end, his brother and the men's children came to greet him, not the brother children. Why do we have to cause such an harm to the brother children? I think that the story begins with the man, his wife, his children, and his brother, and at the end, the man appears again, his own children and brother, and you should believe me that in the manuscripts, the wife is coming out too. So the brother and the wife and the kids all are drowned in the river, and he gets back to an empty house, a lot of gold, and falsifies honor, because the king gave him the honor, not the people. And we learn the lesson: give charity to the true amount. Do not exaggerate, or do not refrain from giving. I would see that's how the story should be understood. But Mr. Leviticus Rabba is fooling us. At the beginning, we believe that this is going to be a simple folk story. But at the end, everything is turned upside down, and the story is more deep, more complicated, more interesting. And it takes me usually 4 to 6 hours with my MA students to convince them that what I did now in 10 minutes is true. So you don't have to accept my reading, but understand that sometimes folk stories were brought into Beit Midrash and Beit Knesset, but twisted, changed, edited, in order, first of all, to fool us all, because we believed it's going to be a simple folk story, and suddenly it's not simple as that. Please rethink about the story and see how complicated it is. Questions to that? Okay. Just for a second. I think the text number one, I forgot to read with you when we spoke about the family. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's such a beautiful story that I decided we have to teach this anyhow if it does not really belong to our subject today. So if we read the story, just stop me and we go on. We did not. Okay, I trust your memory better than mine, Dina. A Roman lady asked Rabbi, it's not Jose, many people say Jose, Rabbi Jose, why buy a theft? The context is very simple. God is putting Adam to sleep, and when Adam is sleeping, he took one of his ribs and shaped it into Eve, right? According to this Roman woman, it was done by a theft. Adam was not aware of that. He took part of his body without signing an agreement or whatever, to consent to operation. It was God is a thief. By the way, we mentioned this Roman woman when we spoke about the story about marriage being so difficult to arrange. The same woman. Imagine, replied he, a man depositing an ounce of silver with you in secret, and you return him a liter of gold openly. Is that theft? He trusted you, gave you an ounce, 28 grams, whatever the ounce. It's not Israeli measurement. An ounce of silver, and you give him back openly a liter, 24 or whatever ounces of gold. Why call it theft? In our words, what did he take from him? A rib. What did he give back to him? A woman. Yet, why in secret? She insisted. She did not buy the answer. But she rephrases it in a more polite way. It's not theft anymore, but why in secret? At first, say Rabbi Yossi, he created her for him, and he saw her full of discharge and blood. Thereupon, he removed her from him and created her a second time. That's the famous answer of the rabbis about the double stories of creation at the beginning of Genesis. Genesis chapter number one, very organized every day. God said, Vahi, you know that. In the sixth day, Zachar u'Nekeva, God created them, Zachar u'Nekeva. And then you go to chapter two, and the whole story is beginning anew. Adam is alone. Lo toviot levado, whatever. For the rabbis, that's one of the answers. Eve was created twice. But the first time, Zachar u'Nekeva, man was created, and man was sitting there looking how the woman is created, and he saw exactly how she is built inside. And he saw that he took the liver and took the womb and took whatever that had. He saw full of discharge and blood, and he couldn't, even when it was completed, you know, a full person, you do not show half a walk. That's in Hebrew we say, lefachot, letipesh, lo marim chatzi avoda. But he saw the woman being created, so he did not find anything nice or interesting in her. That's why God had to put him to sleep. And the second time, he created her, and he got her in the full shape and say, Zot ha'pam, this time is etzem ha'tzamai. Why did Rabbi Yossi did not answer her this way at the very beginning? Because in a way, you are here hinting that God did not succeed in the first creation of woman. He did not took seriously a basic course in psychology of men. And he failed. And the man did not find anything interesting in women, which he knew exactly upside down everything which is in her. So the second time, God, so to speak, kivyachol, learned his lesson and created the women in you. That's his answer. And then something astonishing happening. I can corroborate your words, she observed. It had been arranged that I should be married to my mother's brother, my uncle. But because I was brought up with him in the same, I would say, room, not home, we were brought up together in the same room, I became the original, the ugly, not plain. But anyhow, in his eyes, and he went and married another woman who is not as beautiful as I. He said, I was from the very beginning. When she was born, her uncle was 3 years old. It really can happen when you start giving a birth to a young age. So they were brought together. Together they took showers. Together they sat on the seal, whatever, the pot, whatever. So when they grew up, he didn't find anything interesting in her. And she says, I became uglier, mechoeret be'einav, that's the Hebrew, and he found another woman not as beautiful as me, but as mysterious woman, which he has to decipher all his life. So to understand the married life is to understand the person you are married to. Who exactly, who is he? And that's what happened here. In this context was the story. It once happened that a pious man, Hasid, was married to a pious woman, Hasidah. You know, when I was a child, we were told that Hasidot, what's Hasidah? Shark? No. Stork. Storks are bringing children. This is Hasidah. They were married to a Hasidah, and they did not produce children from each other. Please see the phrase. Lo emidu banim ze mizze. They didn't say that she did not give birth. Both could not have, for some reason, children. Because the rabbis felt that sometimes you cannot blame the woman. You know that after 10 years, that the halacha, ancient halacha, which is not common anymore, that after 10 years of marriage, a man has to marry a second wife or divorce his wife and marry another one. But the one who is divorced after 10 years of not having children can remarry to another person, even someone who has no children yet. Because they believe maybe the next couple may produce something which the first one did not know. Anyhow, they did not produce children from each other. Said they, we are of no use to the Holy One, blessed be He. Whereupon they arose and divorced each other. Again, divorced each other. He did not divorce her. They divorced each other with agreement, mutual agreement. And then the former, the man, went and married the wicked woman, and she made him wicked. While the latter, the woman, went and married the wicked man and made him righteous. This proves that all depends on the woman, or in Yiddish, Shershe la femme. That's the story. It's a very interesting story, especially when you remember that many people believe that the rabbis were mesogamic. No, this story says that basically family life depends on the woman. If she is a pious, the husband will follow her, and otherwise. And the story should be taught 2 weeks ago, but I realized that I did not do it. I wanted to edit now. So if you want to hear the best folk story, which is here, the most beautiful one is text number 5. And here I have a problem. I taught this text many times in many context, but in English it loses its taste. I am very sorry. So let's try to read it in Hebrew and Aramaic, and don't look at the English, okay? I'll explain everything by reading it. That's a story that you could not be translated. By translating the story, you just kill it for the very beginning. Ma'ase betzidon. In Sidon it happened, okay? Why do I care if it's Sidon? We see in a moment. A folk story does not give me a detail if it's not making use of it. It happened in Sidon. You know where Sidon is, right? Sidon, in the Lebanese shore, not far from Tzor and Nahariya and Rosh Hanikra. In Sidon it happened. We start with the English, but go to the Hebrew in a second. That a man took a wife, with whom he lived for 10 years, and she bore no children. We spoke about it. 10 years, no kids. What can you do? You have to divorce her or marry a second wife, which is called in nice Hebrew, Tzara. Tzara? Second wife is called Tzara. When they came to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai to be divorced, and here the name Sidon becomes meaningful, because they bothered to go all the way from Sidon to Tzfat, to Pki'in, to the Meron, when they have Beidin in Sidon, in Tzor, in Afula, in Metula, in Nahariya, in Rosh HaNikra, you name it. They went all the way, 2-3 days, going up the hill, down the hill, whatever, to Shimon Bar Yochai, for him to organize the divorce, which means they're going for asking for help. Because Shimon Bar Yochai, as we know, was a sage, a chacham, who was believed to make miracles. By his prayer, he could heal sick person. He could heal a woman who could not have children, whatever. They went to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai to be divorced. Now let's go to the Hebrew, third line. Amarla, third line. Kol chefetz sheyesh li betoch beiti, tli oto ulechi lebeit avich. I am translating. Everything which I have in my house, what is chefetz? My watch is a chefetz, my phone is a chefetz, my shoes are chefetz. Take any chefetz you want and go to your father's house. L'chi le'bet avich. Okay? Now she has the chance to do whatever she wants. She could take the piano, she could take the Modigliani, she could take whatever. And that's a way a man, that I understand it, can express his love. He gives her her ketubah. He doesn't have to give her anything else than the ketubah, but he says, take whatever you want, but go home. Sorry, I have to divorce her. Amar lahem Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. When Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai heard it, he said to them, Keshem shenizdavagtem mitoch machal umashke, as you were married in a feast of food and drink, a whole celebration, kach ein atem porshin ze mize, separates from each other, ela mitoch machal umashke. What he's suggesting to them, basically? Make a party. Because the divorce is not based on some bad feeling. They have to, the halacha is so harsh on them. So, but some people told me, basically said, you know what, another night. What could happen? Drinks and music and no tension anymore. Who knows, maybe the last night will do something, because, and that's again something I learned from people who know more than I do about psychology, things like that, if the marriage depends on children, the tension in the family does not begin in the ninth year. The second year already, month after month, when the woman sees that she's not pregnant, and men, maybe people tell me the tension can be the reason for not being pregnant. I don't know. So another chance. What can you lose? Anyhow, even after divorce, she has to wait 3 months before she can remarry, because they have to make sure that she's not pregnant from her previous husband. Master, here we have the rhetorical question. What did she do? She is now the one to decide what to do. Master, asta seuda gdola. She made a huge feast. Veshikarto yoter midai, and came in to drink a little too much. Veramza leshifchotea, and called her maidservants. Vamra lahem, tlu oto lebeit abba. Take him to my father's house. See the picture. Middle of the night, vayi b'chatzot alayla, sleeping man in the bed, being carried from his house to her parents' house. B'chatzi alayla, ne'or mishnato. He woke up. Amar lahem, echanen natun, where am I? Amra lo, lo kach amarta, kol chefetz. And here chefetz as the other meaning of chefetz. Chefetz is something that you desire. The translator puts it already in the third line, and kill the story. Take any precious object. Take any object. I should have erased it, but I wasn't clever enough to do it. Take any object. That's what he meant. When Rabbi Shimon heard it, he said, "I'll put the woman to test." He sets the stage. See what happened. If he takes the piano, she takes the Modigliani, she loses everything. And the clever woman understood. But you have to understand that chefetz in Hebrew can mean object, and chefetz something that you really chafetz, something that you really want. It's not only precious things, something that you really want. And she's telling him, "Didn't you tell me so?" Last four lines. Take any object I have in my house, take it and go back to your father's house. I have no more precious object than you. And here in some versions, they cried together. They cried because they understood that they still love each other. And they have to get divorced just because the halacha is not flexible enough. When Rabbi Shimon heard that, he prayed in the couple's behalf. And they were remembered with children, as we wanted it to end. This is the only love story I know in rabbinic literature. And don't tell me about Rabbi Akiva and his wife. The story about Rabbi Akiva and his wife, whom you call usually Rachel, it's love for the Torah. It's love for learning. It's not love between men and women, as this one is. It's very interesting that the only real love story is a folk story. It's found in many European and other societies as well. not in this very phrase, but that's the idea. A woman chooses the husband as the best thing she has, and by that may ten keep the marriage to continue. This story is really a universal story in a way. It ends as we really wanted. What would you say if the end will be, and then in the morning he returned back to his house, and they get divorced, and she lost the piano and the Modigliani and the husband at once? You laugh because it's not, but it won't be a folk story. It may be a realistic, too realistic story, a news in the newspaper, whatever, but that's how the story should go. It ends the way, and I assume that when the story was told at that time, it ended like that, and then they were remembered with children. By the way, if he could pray for them, why didn't he pray the first time they came to him? What's the answer? He has to be sure that this couple is worth praying for them, and that they are divorcing each other just because the halakha demands and not more that. Okay? But when the story was told, probably at that time, it ended something like that. He prayed for them, and they remembered with children, and I still remember the Brit Milah of this child. I wrote the Brit Milah, and the taste of the wine is still on my lips. That's how stories like that end many times, and the story ends in good mood, as expected from a folk story. Have time for another short story before I go home? But I'm talking about 70 minutes English, standing on my foot at the end of the day. It's not very easy. Text number 8. We read only part of it. If you count lines in the English, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The 10th line. When he entered. Okay? Do you find it? 10th line. It's about Rabbi Yoshua, one of the great sages, a very clever person, Chacham, a real Chacham, on the way to Jerusalem. When he entered the city, he met a little girl standing and filling her pitcher from the well. כיוון שנכנס לעיר, מצא תינוקת עומדת ממלאה מן העין. Anyone who knows the Bible and the book of Genesis sees in front of his what? Rebecca and the slave whom you called Eliezer. He said to her, "Give me some water to drink." It's better in the Hebrew. אמר לה, "השקיני מים." That's exactly the way he spoke Eliezer, whatever his name was, to the girl. "השקיני מים." אמרה לו, "לך ולחמורך." She said to him, "Both to you and your donkey." You may remember the Rebecca, Rivka said, "שתי אדוני וגם לגמליך." The same story. Little story. Rabbi Yoshua and the girl are playing Rebecca and the slave. כשפנה, כיוון ששתה ופנה לילך, אמר לה, "ביתי, עשית כמעשה רבקה." אמרה לו, "אני עשיתי כמעשה רבקה, אתה לא עשית כמעשה אליעזר." Wise girl. Usually we do not really believe that kids like that can be sharp as that. But this is the kid of Jerusalem. The whole text is speaking about the wisdom of the kids of Jerusalem. This is one of them. You may read the others. Very simple to understand. And the interesting, it's part of Lamentation Rabbah. In the midst of the Midrash that speaks about the Churban, about destruction, about disaster, in the midst of it, there are stories about the wisdom of the people of Jerusalem, and especially the kids of Jerusalem, as if the author of Lamentation Rabbah is telling us, not everything is lost. We lost our independence, maybe people were killed, where the economy is down the drain, whatever. But as long as we have our wisdom and our kids, there is still hope, and that's the idea that these stories serve. And you kill them and you read them, you'll smile more than once. That's the most humorous stories in rabbinic literature. So don't say, one, that the rabbis are methogenic. They are not. Two, they have no humor. They do. And three, I thank you for listening so kindly to me. Thank you very much. Laila Tov.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.